Begin after six taps. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Hello, and thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host, coked up superhero Lady P, no relation to Master P. And joining me today is FlixWise's art director and fellow traveler, Miss Emma Gerard.
I left my clever introduction on my coat sleeve.
Well, it happens. And making his glorious return to FlixWise is Eclipse Viewer host, Criterion cast member, all sorts of going happenings on the internet, and he's also champion of the working man, Mr. David Blakesley. Welcome back, David.
What I was going to say was written on my sleeve. It just flew off. I can't read. I forgot what I was supposed to say. Sorry. Hello, Pauline. Goodness. Welcome back. Nice to be with you again.
All right. And making his FlixWise debut is expert gibberish interpreter, Mr. Jason Beamish. Welcome to the show, Jason.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I did not did not start with anything clever, and I am also babbling.
It's appropriate, but I like it, some gibberish would be great. There we go.
I think he's miming over there. Too bad
that's
this
Italian,
is a video.
Right?
That's Italian. Yeah. Exactly. All right. For today's sight and sound entry, it's Charlie Chaplin's final depiction of his trademark character, the Tramp. It's the 1936 film Modern Times. We'll reflect on our experiences watching the little man kick up his heels and walk on down the road for the last time. And we'll talk about whether Modern Times still holds up in today's even more modern age. Then for our second topic, we're going to talk more generally about films set in industrialized workspaces and how movies have helped shape our ideas about working in a factory. And finally, we'll close things out with some final notes of positivity. All right, you guys ready to get down to business?
Let's go.
Let's get
modern. Let's get cranking.
Je la pose sa dilatoire.
First up, we have Charlie Chaplin's 1936 feature, Modern Times. Fresh off a long hiatus following his previous artistic and commercial success in City Lights, Modern Times represents the triumphant return of and farewell to the Little Tramp, the character that became synonymous with Chaplin's entire career, basically. The film sees the tramp working on an assembly line, bolting and screwing and pausing for mandated lunch breaks. He struggles to become the efficient automaton that the position demands. This struggle eventually results in a nervous breakdown and subsequent stay in a mental health facility. He's eventually released from the mental hospital, but soon finds himself in a rehabilitation center of a different nature, i.e. prison. While initially ill at ease, the little tramp soon realizes that life in lockup beats working for a living. Unfortunately, he ends up getting released due to good behavior and is put out on the streets again. It's there where he meets the film's love interest, played by Paulette Goddard. This girl, much like the tramp, is an orphan vagabond just trying to get by. When the two meet and fall in love, they determine that it might be nice to indulge in some contemporary modern comforts like a house and furniture, which means it's back to the factory for Charlie. This goes about as well as it did in the first act. Gears are stripped, machines malfunction, spirits are crushed, and the little tramp finds himself out on his butt once more. By the way, it's worth mentioning, this is a comedy. The last act has the tramp and the Paulette Goddard character trying their hands at singing and waiting tables. Unfortunately, hijinks and mayhem follow the tramp wherever he goes, and that job falls away as quickly as it came. In the end, the tramp ends up, much as he started, a penniless troublemaker. But as he makes his final walk on down the road, he's got a girl by his side and a smile on his face. And really, what else do you need in life? As I mentioned earlier, this is the film that Chaplin made after what many consider to be the high watermark of his career, City Lights, which we've previously discussed on this show. But according to the Sight and Sound Critics poll, this is a close second, coming in at number 63 on the greatest of all time list. But is it really worthy of such acclaim? We shall discuss. All right, let's go around the table. Who here likes Modern Times? Let's start with you, David.
I like Modern Times. I like living in them, and I like looking back on the 1936 version of Modern Times, definitely. Mm-hmm. This is a wonderful movie.
Yeah, yeah. Jason, how about you?
I certainly did. I'm not going to say that it's my favorite Chaplin, but it's very, very good from start to finish.
Okay, what's your favorite Chaplin? Now that you brought it up.
Well, that was later in my notes here, but
I see. Well, we can certainly get to that later.
Yeah, we'll handle that.
Okay, listeners, stay tuned. Emma, what do you think of Modern Times?
I like Modern Times.
Okay, all right. I think we're all in agreement. Modern Times, pretty solid. But I guess I kind of want to talk about, let's get right to Jason's prompt, which is it his one of his best movies? Is it his second best movie? Obviously, these things are really difficult to quantify, and no one's asking for an objective quantification. But why does this movie speak to you even to this day? Obviously, there's a certain... you know, it's a silent film. It's about working in a factory, which I don't know about you, but that is not my everyday experience. So, but what does he capture in the film that you think translates to today? Emma, do you have an answer?
That translates to today.
Yeah.
Well, okay, maybe I should say first, I'm really a bigger fan of Chaplin's short films than his feature-length films. I think this is my favorite of his later works because it is kind of just a series of two-reelers stuck together, and I think it's like a really perfect way for him to send off the tramp. And he does a lot of clever things formally to kind of transition him into the sound world and leave him behind in the silent world. The appeal of the tramp to me is that he's just very anarchic, like, and I don't mean only in the sense that he's been in many pie fights,
but not
earlier in his career. there's a lot in this movie about struggling in the modern world and struggling with the way that we devote our lives to creating capital for other people, and the tramp and his girlfriend or whatever the relationship is. But I literally don't know how to pronounce the name of that character. Have you looked that up?
I don't know. Does anyone know? I just say the girl because
the gamine.
Get the gamine. Right. The gamine.
That
yes.
Is, like, so not in our vernacular.
We don't use that anymore. That's true. Yeah. Which is a shame. Let's bring that back. Yeah. but yeah, how about you guys? David, do you want to take that?
Sure. Let me just kind of give a little background. A couple years ago, our mutual friend Aaron West and a couple of his friends put together something called the Criterion Blogathon, which is just kind of get a bunch of bloggers together to each pick a Chaplin movie or something about Chaplin, and or not about Chaplin, but about Criterion. So I did, you know, since I have been doing my blogging thing about so many individual movies, I thought, how about let's just do an overview of the whole Chaplin corpus that Criterion had released at that point. That included streaming films and most of the features all the way up until his last film, The Princess from Hong Kong, I think is the name of that one. That's not on Criterion, but I watched them all in sequence. I listened to some Chaplin biographies, read some books. I mean, just really immersed myself in Charlie's world, going back to the two reelers that Emma referenced earlier. And so a lot of my appreciation for Modern Times, especially now that I've gone through that whole experience, is how brilliantly it was accomplished in its context. I mean, Chaplin really was at this crossroads of an era. He had this, you know, I mean, he was really like the first global superstar of kind of what you might consider the modern world in terms of a face, an image, a reputation that was literally recognized in every country on earth. And so, you know, what does that kind of fame do to a person, and what kind of pressure does it put upon an artist to continually, you know, meet the expectations of a vast global audience? And I think, just, you know, without going on too long, Modern Times really hits that universal note in ways that people really from every culture, you know, that knew of Chaplin at that time, or even today, I think, can relate to. I mean, everybody works, everybody eats, everybody knows people who are poor or have been poor themselves or are struggling, who inadvertently get themselves into any number of different jams or predicaments involving sometimes the police, sometimes, you know, mental health, social services, you know, all that stuff. I mean, so there's a particularity to this story in its setting of the mid-1930s, the Depression era, you know, jobs hard to come by and people scraping by. But, you know, decades later, it's still got incredibly hilarious scenes and a message that, you know, straddles this amazing line of being, you know, enough political to sort of be relevant and have a sort of a social message, but it's not bogged down in any particular partisanship. And I think it's just, it's an amazing synthesis of so many qualities that, that make Chaplin this kind of transcendent artistic figure, or this cultural reference point. So, and as a person, you know, just all the things that he had to do to get this movie made, it's just astonishing, really, when you think of how it all works together. So, yeah, I'm pretty impressed by the whole package here.
Right. Yeah. I mean, while factories have changed in the 90 years or so since this movie, bosses are still basically the same, it turns out.
That's right.
So,
doing their jigsaw puzzles and reading their comics and snooping on the staff, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So there is a universality to this film in the message. Like, we've all felt dehumanized by anyone who's ever worked for a big corporation has, I would venture to say, felt at least a little dehumanized in their work.
Sure. Oh my God, those TVs in the bathroom at my old job.
It's, you know, so yeah, it's kind of a, this film will endure. But Jason, do you want, let's get to your point. It's not your favorite of his features. Tell us quickly which one is.
Well, it's difficult, really. It's, for me, they're more of an experience. So, like, The Great Dictator, that was the first movie, the first Chaplin I watched, the first one I watched with my grandfather, who was a POW, so in World War II. So, like, that had a big part to me. A couple years back, my wife and I had a chance to watch City Lights on the big screen with a live accompaniment. So there's a lot of different things that come together, but that last 2 minutes of City Lights makes that my favorite.
Yeah, that ending, man.
Yeah.
Tell ya, that's a killer.
Mm-hmm.
Em and I were talking yesterday about endings of films and just generally which one, specifically Chaplin films, and which ones are satisfying and which ones aren't, and the different ways that they are satisfying. And that nothing really compares with City Lights. But I would say that this film's ending is actually spectacular as well. It's got that trademark Charlie heading down a long road into the sunset. But this time he's got a companion with him, which is atypical. So I thought that was a really sweet way to bid adieu to this little tramp character.
And quite inspired, too, because he had actually already written a completely different ending involving the gamine becoming a nun and the tramp walking off alone one more time. And somehow this alternate vision came up and he filmed it. And it's just the poetic, you know, mastery really is kind of like this alchemy that just brings it all together and sums up a phase of his career that, I don't think you could come up with a better conclusion, just that
right.
Kind of closing the circle in such a wonderful way.
Exactly, yeah. So this is the farewell to the tramp, but let's talk about the origins of the tramp. Emma, so before we... Just a little backstory on how this whole episode came together. I had initially asked Emma to come on, and she was not available. And then the thing she was doing got canceled at the last minute. But we were really sad when she said no initially, because she told me she had just read two books on Charlie Chaplin. So I'm really, really happy that you could be here to tell us a little bit more about the history.
Oh, thanks for putting me on the spot.
Yeah, yeah. So tell us about
report,
the tramp. Right? Yeah, exactly.
He first started doing it when he first came to America and made his first films at Keystone. Before that, he was doing music hall performances in London which is kind of like the London equivalent of vaudeville. And he didn't really have a character, per se. I think he'd tried a few on, and they'd been really unsuccessful. He just kind of did bits. Like the bit that the tramp does at the end when he's the singing waiter is exactly the kind of thing that was Charlie Chaplin's everyday job before he became an actor for film. And when he started, he had really no idea how to act for film. He almost got fired from his first day at Keystone. Mabel Normand really petitioned to keep him on, and so we have her, I guess, to thank for having the tramp.
Hero.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And he stuck with that character since.
Yeah. I think the word you used to describe him was anarchic, and that about sums him up. Mm-hmm. There is a kind of... He brings mayhem with him, but there's a sweetness to him as well. He's at least, well, initially, he started off much more malicious and eventually grew into this sweet character.
Yeah.
The sweet romantic.
The first film he made as the tramp, he's just sort of like tripping over people and accidentally kicking them in the ass and hitting them with a cane in the lobby of a hotel. And then this first one that actually, like, screened, he's literally just playing a tramp. Like, it's supposed to be, like, a documentary of a car race in Venice Beach. And he's supposed to be just a tramp who's wandering in front of the camera, and they can't get him to leave. Like, that's his one job, is to piss off the cameraman. And it's really funny.
Yeah, and then eventually he transitioned into this more romantic, sentimental hero with... Was it the kid that did it that sort of cemented our idea of him?
No, the kid was more of like one of his first feature-length films, but he had become a sensation through those early shorts, those Keystone and then Mutual comedies, you know, and it was just his popularity. It exploded. It just took off, and, you know, they were making money hand over fist and exporting the films all around the world. It was quite a phenomenon.
Yeah, yeah. But so do you know the kind of turning point where he became less jerky?
There is one film called The Tramp. That was the name of the short.
Okay.
Yeah, that might be the one where it really sort of baked his character into the public consciousness as a standalone thing. And, yeah. You know, and in so many ways, he was really tied to that character for you know, quite a time. And one of his early films where he tried to sort of show his broader side, A Woman of Paris, was kind of a flop because he was just the director. He didn't appear except for one very brief walk-off scene where you hardly even notice it's him. But he tried to make Edna Purviance, his female lead actor of those films, kind of into a bigger star. And it's a really fine film, but it was so different from what the public expected from Lil Charlie that it didn't really catch on. And so he was in many ways locked into the tramp character, and he struggled with that at times. I mean, he recognized it was a huge boon. It was his meal ticket and made him incredibly wealthy and also an autonomous creator because, you know, the studios really couldn't own him. He was able to do his own thing and helped found United Artists because of his popularity and his unique appeal. But, you know, he always struggled for a long time of how to show that he had bigger ideas and ambitions. And that's kind of what happened with the feature films. He kept having to top himself because he recognized he's not just a funny guy. He had higher ambitions. And that's maybe where the films falter a little bit as well, because we love that anarchic, comedic force of nature. And he loves it too. But he wanted to go in some other directions. And so when he does that, you know, he's becoming a little bit more ambitious, sometimes taking a little bit more risks, and sometimes not hitting the sublime heights that maybe he's aspiring to. But he's still just an amazing, you know, character. I think his late films give so much food for thought and are just so interesting to study on their own terms. But they may not have the same sheer joyousness that the shorter films, the earlier films do, which are almost like cartoon-like in nature, but so entertaining.
Gotcha. But by later films, do you mean like these Little Tramp later films, the
feature
lengths, or do you mean Monsieur Vidal?
I think even you know, City Lights. I mean, City Lights, The Circus, Modern Times. You know, they have they're larger in scope. Yeah, certainly everything after Modern Times represents a bit of a departure, and there's going to be, you know, ups and downs in each of those films. But I think they're all quite, you know, quite fascinating and very worthy of closer examination, even if you've seen them once. I mean, somewhat like Emma, I'm kind of curious to know what books Emma's read, because, like I say, when I went through that kind of immersion of reading a couple of biographies, audio books, just reading up on it, it was just, I really got into this whole story of this unique human being and his amazing perception of human emotions and kind of what drives us as people, our relationships, our passions, our vulnerabilities. He's quite a genius, and that's part of what you get in this film, but in so much of his other work as well.
Yeah, I literally can't remember the name of any of the books I've read.
That's fine, yeah.
But I did read his autobiography also,
yeah,
and I would
yeah.
recommend it to anybody. Like, he, as you would expect, is a good writer. Like, it's not great for historic research, but, like, his compassion for humanity and his, like, he, like, got to travel a lot and see a lot of the world, and I think his reflections on that are really great. And if you like his movies, you might like that book, too.
Yeah. Good recommendation. Jason,
what
were
you saying? I feel like we're taking a step away here, because we also have to remember that Modern Times included one of the very first fart jokes.
Yeah.
Did
so
it.
We're making
flatulence
this.
Flatulence and...
Good morning? Or not good morning. What's the Ozu movie?
Oh, yeah, Good Morning. That was 1957, 58, I think, something like that.
No,
yeah,
no,
I'm not saying it's the first. But
one of the first fart jokes.
I was born by.
It was
yeah.
That. Oh, yeah, that one, too. Well, you know, that's the thing. Ozu and Chaplin were really the last of the diehards to stop making silent films. Ozu was in the mid-30s when he was still shooting silent, even as the Japanese industry had moved on as well.
Yeah, that's a really great transition point. Thank you, David. because I do want to talk about Chaplin's relationship to filmmaking technology and how it kind of relates to his relationship to technology in the film, and how his sort of reluctance to kind of get with the times might be reflected in the movie. Do you think there is this sort of meta-textual element in the film, or am I reading way too much into it?
Oh, well,
accurate.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well. Yeah. Basically, I mean, his reluctance to actually have the tramp speak in his own voice, even when you hear the music, you know, even when you hear him singing, it's gibberish, which is a very interesting kind of artful dodge, I'll say, because, you know, he recognized there's a gimmick here, there's an appeal. Finally, we hear the tramp's voice, so there's a kind of a curiosity on the part of the public, but he's not going to give us the pleasure of having the tramp talk like a normal human being, you know. I mean, part of Chaplin's power and his fame and celebrity was based on the fact that, you know, these films were completely universal. I mean, every continent, every language, every walk of life could relate to the tramp character, and that's why he was so beloved, you know, as well as the novelty of movie technology coming into, you know, different nooks and crannies of the world. And so to have the tramp actually start talking in dialogue, Chaplin recognized that that's not something he really wanted to do. He wanted to preserve that intrigue and that universality. And so, you know, he kind of, you know, met us in the middle there. He gave us his actual human voice, but not in words that could even be translated. The mime, the body language was still what was telling that story. And I think, you know, he wanted to keep the intertitles. He wanted to keep the power of facial gestures and slapstick and body language and pathos that kind of speaks above and beyond words as the driving force for his films. And then he made that adjustment with The Great Dictator, and I think he did great work after that. But this was kind of his swan song for what really had made him great and famous and immortal as far as culture is concerned.
Yeah. Jason, do you have anything to add regarding Chaplin and his attitude towards technology that we see in the film?
It's not surprising. What I was thinking when I was reading this earlier was about Singing in the Rain, when they had to make that transition from silent to the talkie, and the great performers of the silent age didn't translate well. You know, so I could see, you know, Chaplin and Keaton and everybody else being a little reserved and concerned that the character that they spent years building would not work.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. It kind of, this movie reminds me of Jacques Tati, which obviously Jacques Tati heavily influenced by Charlie Chaplin, but the specific way that he uses sound effects to comedic effect. Yeah.
The sound design.
Very much.
The music. I mean, Chaplin, and that's the thing. I mean, Chaplin was very involved in the music and the sound, all that. I mean, it's just quite remarkable. I mean, he did draw some talented people all around him, and people who, you know, had the skills, wanted to work with him on this. But again, just okay, now he's going to put a soundtrack on this film, and it's just brilliant how well it all works. You know, the way the music syncs with the action and the gurgling, gastrointestinal stuff.
Right. Yeah. It's true.
It's kind of interesting, Jason, that you brought up like the silent comedians transitioning to sound too, because out of the three of them, Chaplin's really the only one who got a chance to take his old character into sound. Like Harold Lloyd did well in sound, but he couldn't do the boy because he was getting too old, and then Keaton couldn't do his character because he lost his independent production company. And so this is like the only movie of the three geniuses where we do see their silent character.
Yeah.
What do you guys?
Yeah, I guess for, I mean, we can get into the debate of who's our favorite or whatever. It's not really a debate because it's Buster Keaton. But
moving on now.
Yeah. Anyway, but I mean, the thing is, with Chaplin, the voice and the character fit together reasonably well, unlike Buster Keaton and his thick, like, Midwestern, like, deep voice. It's like, it's so jarring to hear it. On a certain level, it makes sense that Chaplin would be the one who would have the opportunity to do it, you know?
Well, in the transition to sound, you have Modern Times moving on to Great Dictator. And I didn't really feel like his characters in Great Dictator were very far away from the Tramp. It was the same, to me, thinking back, it's a very similar character. Whereas then you move into Monsieur Vardot, if I said that correctly, and it's a fully fleshed out talking character. And that I actually enjoyed greatly when he really got into dive into that.
Yeah. No, it's a really fascinating movie. Yeah, I think you're right that he was the only one really given an opportunity to make that transition. Harold Lloyd, he was in a Preston Sturges movie. Am I crazy?
Was
he? I want to say he was, but I could be making that up.
Talkies, like, I mean, well, who did the Milky Way?
Oh, dear.
It's Sturges-esque, but it's not Sturges.
Okay.
I mean, like, it's good. It's funny, and he's good in it. It's just that he can't be glasses anymore.
Right, right. You know? Yeah.
And he put on a lot of weight, too.
Yeah.
There are a significant amount.
Yeah. It happens.
Oh, yeah.
He can't be young and beautiful forever. But yeah, David, do you have any thoughts about basically the rivalry between the three of them and whether... Do you compartmentalize them in certain ways?
Well, I've certainly invested myself more deeply in Chaplin's story, and I am very moved by kind of where he came from, the struggling, you know, London slum, you know, kid, born in the music hall world, and you know, having read his story and really thought long and hard about it. I don't know the biography of Keaton or Lloyd nearly as well. And so I definitely, you know, I'm not going to argue with you, Pauline. I like you too much for that. But I'm definitely more of a Chaplin fan. But it's really just because of the immersion and just because the, you know, the time I've spent and the amazing story that of the life he lived, you know. he's a very complex, very interesting human being, sometimes a bit of a scoundrel, and maybe we can talk a little bit about some of that as well, because he was a guy who kind of came from the old school of cribbing other people's ideas and riffing on his own past. I mean, Modern Times really is a bit of a greatest hits tour, because a lot of the gags that we see in it, with a few notable exceptions, I mean, the winding through the machinery gears, sure, and all of that, those are iconic moments that are just, you know, universal and unforgettable. But a lot of the roller skating scene goes back to an early shirt called The Rink, and actually some of the waiter gags, you know, going in through the outdoor and knocking over and you know, kind of carrying the tray through the crowd. I mean, that's stuff that he had all done before. Emma already talked a little bit about his music hall shtick and, you know, kind of miming and, you know, the song and dance numbers and stuff. And so really this was kind of Chaplin bringing out, you know, the moldy oldies one more time, for the amusement and entertainment of people who'd grown up on his stuff, as well as a younger generation of kids who had maybe, you know, seen some of the movies or heard about them, and now they're seeing a new Charlie movie kind of for the first time. And so, yeah, he's playing to a diverse group of audience members. And again, I think he just does such a nice job of culminating this phase of what he was doing here. Against all odds. I mean, again, he lived a very complicated personal life as well. And so there were scandals, there were lawsuits, there were all kinds of distractions weighing in on him. And to work through all of that and to put this gem of a movie together is pretty remarkable.
That's interesting, David, that you said about the new audience. Yeah. Because I don't know if you saw, I don't know if it's on the Criterion disc or on the Filmstruck just streaming, there's a documentary about a couple guys in Cuba back in the 60s that drove around.
It is on is on Modern Times, the Blu-ray. It's on the disc. Supplement. Okay.
But so if you ladies hadn't seen that, it's two guys in Cuba that just drive around and have a projector in their truck, and they go around to small cities or small towns and villages and show people, you know, from 6 to 80, their first movie. And what they showed was Modern Times.
Yeah, this
is very cool.
It's about a 20-minute short. It was filmed in 1967. So this is, you know, fairly fresh off the revolution. And they had, these are mountain villages up in the really high, you know, craggy. I mean, there's like no electricity. They do some interviews with some of the locals, campesinos, you know, the peasants, who really they don't even have like electricity up there. They had to bring on a generator just to power up the projector and put the people in this little scene. And it shows them the scene of Charlie and the feeding machine, you know, cutting those efficiencies. And you see these people, you know, probably a lot of them, you know, barely literate, if literate at all, poor and you know, only having the vaguest notions of what life in America might be like, life in the USA. But they're just laughing and busting a gut because it is just, it's so hilarious.
That's amazing. If I had never heard of an assembly line, I think that would be terrifying. But I'm glad that the humor translates. It would just be like a horror show. But that's I have to check that out.
But, you know, but it's just this fun, this, you know, tightening nuts, you know, and that's the thing. It's not even complex assembly. It's just tightening nuts,
right.
nuts. And I mean, everybody can relate to some basic mechanical gesture like that. Everybody can relate to being fed or being hungry and looking for food. I mean, it's just.
No, that's true. Well, David, you touched on Chaplin's sort of sordid personal history.
Yes.
I think perhaps maybe we should just talk about it and how it relates to his depiction of women. This is where most of the time I can pretty easily divorce the films from the scandals or whatever. But when it comes to the way he represents women, it forces me to sort of recall all of those very kind of disturbing aspects of his personality.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, but yeah, and in this sense, you know, I do think Paulette Goddard breaks the mold a little bit, because she is, there's something about her that's a little bit different than the typical Chaplin female lead or romantic character.
Right.
I don't know. Do you guys agree?
Well, just to contrast, I forgive me for not remembering the name of the woman who acted in City Lights, but you know,
right.
he verbally abused her. He drove her to tears. It was pretty, it was very disturbing to read that. And another favorite of mine, Ingmar Bergman, you know, he had an awful personal life. And, and I do, I was thinking about this the other day. It's like, is there something about these artists, these creators who are so in tune to emotions and so dedicated to, sort of presenting truth in their art about how the human mind and heart operates, that they somehow demand that in their own lives, or they pursue that in a way that really just tramples roughshod over the people closest to them. Like, if they feel an urge, if they feel a lust, an arousal, a rejection, scorn, disrespect, they just let it rip. They just act on it. And because they're so dedicated to that truth, the people around them have to pay this awful price. And yet they're very charismatic and easy to fall in love with. And but you're kind of falling into a spider's web, because, you know, he will move on and he will leave you behind. And maybe almost to Paulette Goddard's credit, I think maybe she recognized that and moved on on her own terms after she had had a ride. I mean, he was basically twice her age when they got together. He did make her a star. She did have a career independent of him. But also kind of like Hitchcock and his women, he you know, they want to have this absolute control. And that sometimes is just too high of a price to pay. So, yeah, I'm very fascinated by the Paulette Goddard's contributions to this film. I'm kind of interested to hear what the women have to say about her role and all of that.
Yeah. Emma, do you like to take that? I mean, to me, like, I think she has more personality than most Chaplin female characters.
I agree.
In that, you know, she has, we actually get to see, she's more than just like a helpless victim. She is a go-getter. She gets them the job at the dining hall. She takes it upon herself to get food for her family. She's generally an optimist. And I also think, you know, Paulette Goddard is a star, and it became clear, like, she didn't need him. And also, she was a little bit older than the typical Chaplin heroine. She lied about her age, I think, but she was in her late 20s, I think, when this was filmed, so...
Ancient.
Yeah, I know, real, honestly.
Well, for Charlie's taste in women, that was definitely past the expiration date.
Exactly, yeah, so, I think that, and that, I think, is part of why this film is so strong, is because you do have this great co-lead. It's not just the Charlie Chaplin show. To the extent that he allowed her any time in the spotlight. And I mean, it's also not, it wasn't just Charlie who is hogging the spotlight. Like, all three of the guys we mentioned today, you know, they're all the show, the spotlight is always on them, right? But it just so happens that Charlie, I guess he liked his women a little younger, a lot younger. But yeah, it's tough. It's hard to reconcile that in my mind and still appreciate. I mean, we talked about how in tuned he is with, you know, humanity and just in emotions, and I guess the question becomes, is he in tune, is that really as universal as we think, or is that a specifically masculine perspective?
And is it sort of a shrewdness, like he knows how to kind of almost exploit human sentimentality,
right?
You know, he knows what makes people tick, and so he does it in a way that makes him very wealthy and very privileged, and you know, he does live you know, like a prince. He lives very grandly and in some ways feels entitled to do things that probably he knows are wrong or hurtful, but who's there to stop him, you know?
Right, right.
But that's the interesting thing about the Gamine is that she knew what she could do to get ahead.
Right.
Just as the female, both as a character. And I mean, to my money, Paula Goddard is in a different weight class than the other of Chaplin's love interests.
Like Edna Purviance and others. Yeah.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, although you gotta love her.
And I think Charlie did love her. I mean, he's definitely loving her on screen. She's getting wonderful close up. She's got a great look to her. I think I said in one of my review is like just the way her hair hangs kind of naturally, and that's not what you see in 1930s films.
Right.
Usually the hair is all done up, and of course she does have some of those moments towards the end when her showgirl dancing outfit and all of that. But there's just a vitality to her presence that's really very refreshing. I mean, it really stands up as a strong performance, cross-cultural, across decades.
Right, yeah. David, when we were initially talking about discussing this film, you mentioned that there were accusations that the premise or some elements of the film might have been plagiarized.
Yeah, well, there was a very significant lawsuit brought by the studio that produced René Clair's film A Nous la Liberté, or Liberty for Us. This was a 1931 French film. This was a talkie. This was early in the sound era. And René Clair is one of the kind of, you know, not founding fathers, but he was definitely a pretty major figure of French cinema, right as that transition from silent to sound. He was somewhat affiliated with some of the surrealists and did a couple early Criterion Spine numbers, Under the Roof of Paris and Liberty for Us, or A Nous la Liberté. And there's a factory setting scene where there's kind of a manic assembly line scene of the products being shipped faster, and these are prisoners who are in a jail-like setting, or in a jail setting, and there's kind of this kind of wacky moment of the assembly line speeding up and antics ensue, and so there, and even the angle from which it's shot, you know, there's a very clear similarity, and so the producers of this film, when they saw Modern Times, launched a very expensive and really probably in legal terms kind of a big overreach. They were looking for not only a very large financial settlement, but confiscation and destruction of all prints of Modern Times. I mean, they were really trying to obliterate the film. And I don't know if they did this because they thought, sue high and settle lower, or if they really thought they had a chance at winning. But it was a significant thorn in Chaplin's side. He claimed to have never seen the film. But again, his track record in these things wasn't exactly trustworthy, and I think again he is like, maybe he never saw the whole film, maybe he just got a verbal fill-in or somebody said, yeah, this would be good. But I think there's a plausibility to the idea that he was inspired or in some sense aped that scene and made it his own. And of course it's a magnificent scene. Nobody's saying that Modern Times isn't funny, but right. It was enough to get some traction in court, even though ultimately Chaplin and his his lawyers
there's a history, as you mentioned, there's a history of him kind of borrowing ideas from other people, and famously Orson Welles claimed that he stole the idea of Monsieur Verdot from him. So
he's credited, though.
He is. Yeah. This is his idea. I don't know. I guess he took umbrage when he did it without his permission or something. I don't know. Jason, what were you going to say?
Well, I watched the René Clair film this morning just to get an idea about it. And the two scenes are they're almost identical in that momentary fact when Chaplin is using the wrenches. They're building turntables, record players. And
cool.
Like the angle is almost the same, but Modern Times is heads above in entertainment value from it.
Okay.
Yeah. I think there's kind of a notion, too, that came later about, like, originality in comedy that wasn't really a thing, especially when Chaplin started out. Like, in the music hall, you don't necessarily come up with your own things. You do each other's bits. Everyone does it different. They do it their own way. And that's part of comedy.
Intellectual, like, property didn't have its own kind of special legal department or anything like that.
But also the expectation that comedians are like these inspired geniuses who come up with like their own new brilliant ideas from the ether whenever is like kind of a modern idea as well. And I mean, and everyone references Chaplin and he never had a problem. Like, you know, there's so many Chaplin references in Disney.
Yeah.
And there's actually a Mickey Mouse in modern times. So maybe that's there true. Is a little, you know, a little give and overlap. Take there.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, well, I think that leads us into a good spot to close out this part of the conversation. But let's ask the final question. Modern Times is the 63rd greatest movie of all time, according to the Sight and Sound Critics poll. Is it worthy of the 63rd spot? Emma, what do you think?
I think it should be switched with City Lights.
Wow. Okay. That's a good answer, which we will not dig into right now. David, how about you?
I think it should be ranked higher on the list. I mean, just coincidentally, listening to your most current episode, I don't know if you've recorded any since, but I listened to your chat with Martin and Scott about The Mother and the Whore as number 59, like ahead of this. And I mean, after all the things that I've said about how this film is this like this kind of world cultural touchstone reference point, you know, I think it belongs much higher, whereas the movie that you guys discussed, which was a great podcast, I haven't seen it. I've watched enough of that clip, the clips that I found on YouTube to kind of get the vibe of The Mother and the Whore, but you know, that's as much of a commentary on who gets to vote on the Sight and Sound list
as
how this film really ranks in the annals of cinema. So this film is probably a top 50. If you're really talking about the whole history of cinema, this is pretty way up there. I'd say, you know, when we start talking top 25, you're still getting so subjective, but this is a pretty major film. But again, Chaplin's in some ways almost in competition with himself. Like, you know, if you got to spread it around a little bit, how do you pick the one? I might put City Lights a little bit ahead of it, but this one here is they're neck and neck. What can I say?
Right. Yeah. Jason, how about you?
I agree with what most of you are saying. I clicked through the list, and I saw Spirit of the Beehive was below it.
Yeah.
And I would rather watch Spirit of the Beehive than Modern Times.
Fair.
However,
but that just means Spirit of the Beehive is way too low. But
yeah. Oh, definitely.
Story. Yeah.
And
yeah.
like the, I actually ordered a CDR of The Mother and the Whore years ago when I thought about doing the whole top 250. I haven't watched it.
Okay. It's somewhere. You'll get around to it eventually. Yeah.
But it's just, you know, those epic length films, especially in French, it just didn't really get my attention. Also, like history du cinema should not be on the list at all.
Absolutely.
Let alone top 30. So.
Yeah. If you get a chance, I recommend our episode on that one. I think most of our panel agrees with you.
Yeah.
But we do have one person defending it, and I think he does a pretty good job. So, but that's a separate matter. But Modern Times, do you think 63 is too high?
I think that with the ebb and flow of the other films, it would maintain its place pretty close.
Okay,
but
yeah.
I think it right around 50, 60, that's not a bad place for it.
Yeah, I agree. You know, we have City Lights in the top 50, and that's, I don't know if it's his finest work. I think Modern Times makes me laugh the most, which is not nothing. But City Lights and that bloody ending, I tell ya. It's so good.
and what you guys were saying earlier about how Modern Times it's essentially a series of two-reelers.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
And those, like, I put on, if I'm having a terrible day, I'll pop in a disc of his shorts. And the day won't necessarily get better, but I will have forgotten about all that. So I love that, just being able to be lost for a couple minutes. And Modern Times does deliver. The skating scene is one of the finest filmed.
Yeah. Yeah, so, that alone.
Yeah, exactly. Just his actual physical skill on the skates. And it's like, what can't the guy do? You know, music,
exactly.
Filmmaking, the physical stuff.
Has he ever ridden on the handlebars of a motorcycle for fun?
That is true. Fair point. Has he actually broken his neck doing any of these stunts? I think not. Well, Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times is certainly one of the most enduring screen images of factory life. It was not the first, nor was it the last film to represent the everyday struggle of the working man. For today's second topic, we're going to discuss the ways in which cinema has helped shape our perception of life in these industrialized workspaces, and we'll talk about a few of our favorite examples. Okay, so where to begin? This is such a big topic because a lot of cinema history involves depiction of factories. In fact, one of the very first films was about people leaving a factory. Yeah.
So, they had the right idea. Get out.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But I guess this is a kind of a very broad question about how much cinema has shaped our ideas about depicting labor on film. And just maybe we can just go over some examples of how it's these depictions are used as kind of, it can be used as a polemical tool or as propaganda, or I mean, that's generally how I think about these things. A lot of the time it is used to comedic effect, as in Modern Times, but more often than not, I think of Eisenstein, frankly. Emma, do you have thoughts?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because a lot of film comes from America, and as in the time period that film has evolved, it's also a time period where American labor has moved largely away from manufacturing and into service.
Yeah.
So I actually couldn't think of a lot of examples right away when you told me about this. Like, the first thing that popped into my head was an episode of Kids in the Hall where they're working in a sausage factory, and it's very much, I think, a kind of spoof of older European movies, and there's kind of the idea that that's quaint, Gen Xers never will end up in a sausage factory, even though obviously someone has to work in a sausage factory.
Right, yeah.
We still have sausages.
Exactly, yeah. It's one of the few industries that has not, that we can't really export, or we can, but we still do a lot of food manufacturing here.
Yeah.
So maybe we can broaden this topic out a little bit, because while there are a lot of, there aren't as many steel mills as there were, and we don't make as much. We still export a lot of raw material, but we don't. There isn't as much wrench turning or riveting as there was back in the early 20th century.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of interesting documentary work about how industrial processes have been globalized, though. Even some of those movies like Baraka show some factories, but I was more recently Manufactured Landscapes, which is actually about Edward Bertinsky photographing these processes, but you do get to see them in the process. And the way that agriculture has been industrialized, our daily bread, is a really good documentary.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, Manufactured Landscapes was on my list as well, how it's really transforming the geography and the, that opening tracking shot, isn't it? It feels like it's 10 or 12 minutes long of just one long track down this huge factory in China, and then how the workers are all kind of regimented almost in military formations in their uniforms doing their exercises. It's like, wow, this is human beings themselves are almost being manufactured for this purpose. It's a pretty stunning film.
Absolutely, yeah.
I'm even thinking, how about Metropolis, kind of going back to the basic
sources.
Let's
start from the beginning, yeah.
Fritz Lang's Metropolis. I mean, it is kind of almost sets the standard for kind of oppressive, dehumanizing, you know, almost, you know, cannibalizing forces, just devouring bodies and minds as much as it, you know, melts steel and forges it into different configurations. And the psychological effect of having to spend, you know, the better part of one's day and one's weeks and years of one's life in that environment. And what does it actually do to the people who, you know, that's just their lot, that's just their condition.
To me, the propaganda in the polemic, you don't see a lot of happy labor films. And it's almost to a point where the factory is just a trope so that we can immediately connect with a character. A couple years back, the film Suffragette. Just to connect you more deeply, she works in a sweatshop doing laundry. So you can automatically connect to how hard this person's life is. Without having to go through a whole long exposition.
No, I think that's a really good point, that the factory just becomes shorthand for miserable life.
I think about the opening scenes of Malick's Days of Heaven, you know, setting the steel foundry. And it's basically, this is the hell that this character is escaping from. So now that we've established that, let's get out to those vast open prairies and spacious skies.
But on the other side, though, it also is an image of hard work. So I was thinking just right now about like Rudy, you know, his family worked in a factory, owned the factory, but you could see just from that moment that he comes from a hardworking family and he's just trying to get ahead.
And that makes him a very sympathetic, especially for the audience that Rudy is pitching itself to, you know, hardworking everyday folks, blue collar types, and the guy who's kind of worked his way up into ownership and running the place. You know, people have a respect for those characters and those figures in their own lives. And so that's kind of Rudy's stock. That's where he's coming from. And so you're prepared to root for this kid to succeed.
I mean, the larger point there that you that we're sort of getting around is like, how accurate are these depictions of factory life? They're always... they're always, generally speaking, because there is this shorthand, they're always generally seen as kind of miserable. Like, this is where you do not want to end up. But how accurate is that, really? Is it, is that fair to those people who actually do work in these spaces?
Yeah, and it's always through the gaze of people who've devoted their lives to being filmmakers. Of factory workers. Although, one movie I think is kind of, like, more fair to, that's recent and American, is Extract. I mean, it's not a completely positive depiction of manufacturing work, but it's Mike Judge, and I think kind of the way that he... disdains all jobs equally.
And it's also, we, you know, he is he draws very specific portraits of workplaces, and as we can draw upon his previous works to and understand, like, this place is no worse than any other job that he's going to show us.
I'd rather work at the better Extract place than Inatech.
But yeah, are there any other instances that you guys can think of where the factory is not the worst place in the world?
It's
where
been
people
a long,
get to be people.
It's been a long time since I saw it, but Norma Rae, Sally Field's Oscar winner, I'd like to check that out again sometime, because I think my impression is that the factory was portrayed as a place, you know, where people work and get along and build relationships, and then of course there's the strike and there's the whole kind of, you know, labor movement, and she's the woman who kind of rises up from the ranks and rallies the forces for good and all of that. But again, that's a very almost cliche, generic take on the film, because, like, it's been a long time since I've seen it. But my impression was that did try to maybe portray working class factory life in a little bit more of a, you know, hey, this is what we do, this is how we feed our kids and raise our families, and, you know, and we all get along together. Again, another attempt to kind of, you know, forge a bond with the working class audience of people who, you know, either have worked in that environment or still do work in that environment, or at least are sympathetic. You know, they've got friends and acquaintances and loved ones who spend that time, you know, in the manufacturing world. And mm-hmm. and then I also think about some of the, you know, early Michael Moore documentaries, Roger and Me and The Big One, where he's really talking about the loss of that kind of income and that kind of you know, that the culture that had grown up around the car plants and the, you know, upward mobility that it did offer to a lot of folks without a lot of education, but they sure. could still make a decent living and send their kids to college and hope for something better. And that was kind of the a version of the American dream for several decades, and then it kind of all fell apart.
Oh, the film I thought of was from 2002, Real Women Have Curves.
Mm, yeah.
Where it's a factory. It's a, you know, a textile factory, and it's a family, and they do their best to have fun doing it.
Yeah. That's a great example.
Yeah, America Ferrera's trying to get out. Yeah, mm-hmm. you know, move up in the world, but you get to see people doing their best to enjoy themselves while they have to work.
Right, right, yeah.
Hey, one other one I'll throw in there real quickly is a documentary by Louis Malle called Human All Too Human. Keith Enright and Trevor and I talked about that one in one of our Eclipse Viewer episodes from late 2016, and it's almost a wordless documentary of people working in a French automotive plant in the early 1970s. And I know Keith has said it's like one of his favorite films of all time, and it is basically just about the monotony and the repetition and the specialization of factory life. And then there's a very interesting kind of scene cut in where the cars are in the showrooms and the cars are being sold to a, you know, fairly affluent upper middle class bourgeoisie, you know, set of customers, and yet the people who are actually making those products kind of come from a different stratum of society. So I'll throw that one as kind of a real life depiction, still through Louis Malle's lens, and he still does the editing interpretation of it, but it is based on the reality of what happens on the assembly line.
Yeah, actually, it's funny you mentioned The Eclipse Viewer, because the one film that I thought of besides Extract was a film we talked about on your podcast, Major Barbara.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, of course.
And it sort of romanticizes life to completely ridiculous effect.
Oh, yeah, we're giving these poor, ignorant peons a shot at the good life.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. That's a... That's an argument, I suppose.
An attitude that's disappeared.
Not even a little bit. Yep.
Yeah. Right.
Exactly. And on that note, thank you. But should we close things out? Just a couple, maybe a few more examples that we wanted to throw in there.
I feel like I have to mention the Dürer's face because
yes,
it is
thank
a direct
you.
Reference to... Modern Times.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
that's a great movie to put on at a party if people are not aware of Disney's war propaganda movies.
Yeah, so Der Führer's face was
it's Donald Duck. It has a nightmare that he's living in a Nazi controlled country and his job is working in an ammunition factory, and he has a mental breakdown much like the tramp does in Modern Times.
It's pretty spectacular. Yeah. Seek that one out. How about you guys?
I think I gave all my suggestions.
You gave yours away. Jason, you got anything else?
Well, interesting about the car factory. I have the Plain Archive edition of Modern Times, and it had two special features on there. One was, looks like, I think I'm pretty sure it was sponsored by the Ford Motor Company. But it was called Symphony of F, Symphony in F. And it had like a feel from like a Poyanikotsky, that sort of video essay.
Yeah, right.
Where then, like, the cars, they start to animate the cars at the end. It's weird. But also on that disc is a silent industrial film from the Department of Labor and the Bureau of Women talking about safety in factories. And
gotta be careful.
Yeah, but it's kind of funny.
Yeah.
But also
wear your hard hat. Yeah,
safety videos are always funny. Like,
yeah,
they still are.
Yeah, yeah.
But then you take out, it's silent, completely silent. So like they made like little rhymes up to help you remember to wear your hard hat.
Yes.
They were probably awesome. Made to be shown on projectors that did not have speakers installed. So
absolutely.
Just an industrial training video.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I'm surprised they're still not showing them, frankly. They don't update those all that much.
Now they have PowerPoints, right?
That's true, yeah.
I mean, I've had a few jobs where I had to watch safety videos that were easily produced in, like, at least 30 years ago.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Sure. You know, not lifting things with your knees locked is, like, doesn't need a lot of updating.
That is true, yeah.
You can wear a Cosby sweater.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Yeah, wear your hard hats, people. All right, cool. Well, I get listeners can tell us some of their favorites. It's just about quitting time for us. But before we clock out, let's go around the horn and share some final notes of positivity. David, let's start with you. Can you talk for a minute about a movie, TV show, book, article, artwork that you've enjoyed recently?
I am working my way through a book called At the Existentialist Cafe with the subtitle Freedom, Being, and Apricot Cocktails with Jean-Paul Sartre, Simone de Beauvoir, Albert Camus, Martin Heidegger, Maurice Merleau-Ponty, and others. This is a book by Sarah Bakewell, and I'll try not to ramble on too long, but I've just been kind of thinking about the times we live in and this kind of creeping fascism and mess that our society and American politics and other parts of the world is kind of descending into, and what is a person to do in these times? And so I've been thinking about existentialism, philosophy, phenomenology, and all this kind of stuff is a way of responding to these, awful situations. And so this book, it just kind of came to my attention as I was kind of searching around. And this is it does involve philosophical discourse a bit, but it's really more of a biography of what those figures, Sartre de Beauvoir and others that I mentioned in the subtitle, were doing in those years of the 1930s as, Europe descended into fascism and the world kind of embarked on a collision course with war and destruction and calamity. And it's just kind of an illuminating history, somewhat biographical, but really anecdotal. So it's not just purely about ideas. It's about the people and their response to the ups and downs of culture. And I've actually drawn some encouragement, even though some of the stories, anecdotes related in that book are a bit depressing. They do give me sort of a perspective on how a person can respond when the world seems to be going crazy around them. So I'm just halfway through it, but I would recommend it if people are interested in learning from history's lessons.
What was it called again?
It's called At the Existentialist Cafe, and the author's name is Sarah Bakewell. And she herself kind of went through a philosophical phase and wanted to learn more about who these people were as human beings rather than just the books and the ideas that they're famous for. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Sounds fascinating. Jason, what you got?
I have actually also been reading a book, not that one.
Good for you.
That's a little heavy for me. but it's the new Neil deGrasse Tyson, Astrophysics for People in a Hurry.
Okay.
It's heavy, but it's also pretty light. So he wants to teach you the science, but he also realizes that only like real, real deep nerds are going to want to go heavy. So
right.
He gives you what you need to be conversational and then I guess sound smarter than your friends.
I mean, isn't that what we all strive for? I think,
Where's that smart pill when I need it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I don't know. We're all, like, grappling with some pretty big ideas here. Emma, played
Sprint
a good video
times,
game lately?
Actually, I'm dealing with this whole, world falling apart thing by retreating into, dystopian future stuff.
Okay.
And I'm really into the games and writing of Porpoise Charity Heartscape. Actually, I've been into her stuff for a while. And she actually has a lot of free stuff that you can play online. She's really sharing with her art. She experiments with Instagram and YouTubing and all kinds of internet persona stuff on top of the more standalone artworks that she makes. And she was actually represented at the Whitney Biennale this year.
Very cool.
I think it's really cool to see gaming in an art institution.
And what's her name again?
Sure. What? Porpentine Charity Heartscape.
That's a great name.
Yeah. Porp for short.
Porp. Yeah. Okay. All right.
Wonderful. You
can check that out. Yeah, we'll link to the website. Okay, and I have mine, I think, is more pedestrian, but we all cope in our own way. So I I just watched Maria Bamford's new comedy special on Netflix. And, you know, it's I love Maria Bamford. I think she's probably the funniest comedian working today. And there's something, her brand of humor, I think, really stands out from what is normally considered to be sort of the great comedians of our age, namely, you know, Louis C.K., Patton Oswalt. I didn't mean to just mention men, but you know, it's a factor. But I think there's something really special about Bamford, in that my expectations for stand-up comedians are that they should do something surprising. And Maria Bamford never fails to surprise me. Like, there's just, there's this sort of unpredictability about her. And I really dig it. And so she's sort of figured out a way to be like weird and sort of shocking without being a jerk, which it's hard to do. Still, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. So yeah, check it out. I think like all of her specials, it's worth watching. And that's the way we frame it. Flicks-wise, that is. Listeners, what's your favorite movie about the working man? Come let us know if we left anything out on our website, flickswise.com. Or you can come tell us on our Facebook page, facebook.com/flickswise. And if you want to come have it out with me on the age-old Buster Charlie feud, you should probably come find me on Twitter. The handle is @flickswise.
But the answer is still Keaton.
The answer is absolutely still
it
Keaton.
It is definitely Keaton.
If sorry, you need David. Some backup for Charlie, just call me, folks. I'm on your side. We'll duke it out.
All right. But before we do all of that, please, please go to iTunes or your pod player of choice, rate us, subscribe, and tell the fat cats at Apple that we should keep up all the good work. Where they fire us and we have a nervous breakdown.
Yeah, I think Flickswise just needs to be at that top line there of a
think
podcast.
So too. Absolutely. Yes. And on our next show, I believe we have Howard Hawks's Rio Bravo and the return of our special guest Joseph McBride. So stay tuned for that. Until then, Jason, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for
where
having
can
me.
Folks find you on the internet?
I am on Twitter at Admiral Beamish. It was a field commission years ago.
Sweet.
What?
Sweet.
Oh, cool. also, I write at filmruminations.com, which
awesome.
After you buy a domain name, you realize ruminations is not a great domain name.
I feel you. Is that F-L-I-C-K or X? Anyway, David, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Always a pleasure, Lady P, and ready to be back whenever you need me again. So,
of course. And any up to any mischief on the internet lately?
Well, Trevor and I just did a kind of a main episode for Criterion Cast on Katharine Hepburn, Spencer Tracy's Woman of the Year. And
you are
boy,
speaking my language.
I
yes.
know. I really, it was a great episode. I think it would have benefited from a woman's voice and all of that. But it's just me and Trevor just talking it out. But I think we had a pretty good conversation about the numerous issues and interesting points raised in that film. So maybe we'll have to talk a little bit offline, because I would really love to hear your take on that. But I do invite listeners to check it out on CriterionCast.com, which is where I host all my other writing and podcasting these days.
Sweet. Awesome. Emma, I know you're social media averse.
A little bit.
But hopefully, with any luck, and as long as we're a little bit diligent, people can probably check... Well, people can check out your handiwork on our website. All of your drawings are up there, obviously.
And they're great. I really appreciate your work, Emma.
Indeed. And, yeah, hopefully we will soon have a site up where you can actually purchase swag with the drawings on it. That's the idea. We're working on it, people. Yeah, we'll keep you posted. Yet another reason to follow us on Twitter. Until then, I guess our work here is done. I can't help it.
Let's go off
to
the sunset.
Anyway, smile, what's the use of crying?
You know,
anyway.
I saw Josh Groban sing that song a few years ago when he was in my town, and he remarked at the end that Charlie Chaplin had written that song, and I had never made the connection before. But,
yeah.
There's a Liberace version of that song.
I'm sure, which is the definitive version. Yes.